Hi, this is Corey Olson, and welcome to Students of the Word. This podcast consists of recordings of the weekly Bible study I've started running in February of 2022. I'm doing close reading, which means we're going very slowly, thinking really carefully about the words, how everything fits together, and then, of course, also thinking about what this means for us and what we do with it. Thanks for listening, and I pray that God will bless the reading of His Word as we study together. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome back to Students of the Word. This is session number 53, and today we begin paragraph 11 after spending... Oh, wait, it's paragraph 10. I'm losing count already. Let's count. It was paragraph 9 that we just finished. I'm getting ahead of my... I'm so excited. I'm jumping ahead. So here, hang on. All right, so we had paragraph 1, which we'll come back to that today, and paragraph 2, we'll come back to that today, too. Right. 3, of course, is where we got to the keeping his commandments and the coming to know him. Paragraph 4 was the not writing a new commandment, but kind of writing a new commandment. And the first time we got the love of one's brother mixed into that. Paragraph 5 is the poem. Right. That was awesome fun. Paragraph 6 is the introduction of the loving of the world. Now, we're going to see this coming up again. We saw this creep in briefly in the last paragraph, and we're going to see it creep in again in a similar kind of way. We'll look at that in a little bit. This paragraph 6, the love of the world and the love of the versus the love of the Father. Paragraph 7, of course, is the long Antichrist paragraph, both when he is sort of talking about this eschatological stuff, you know, the last hour stuff and the Antichrist stuff, but also connecting it not only with those who left, right? The apparently historical concerns, right? Of the people, you know, the actual real life concerns of the people whom he's addressing. But also, of course, where we get this idea of the anointing and the anti-anointing, the charisma and the anti-charisma. So this is paragraph 7. Paragraph 8 was the sort of mind-blowing paragraph where he starts talking about where he pays off the technia stuff, and we're the children of God, and he talks about what we will be and focuses on purifying himself. And then paragraph 9, indeed, the big paragraph we've been talking about for quite some time now, the really thorny, difficult paragraph where we're beginning to see this kind of paradox, as I was discussing at the end of last time. Working in and the way that he's kind of importing that present, that future into the present in the ways that we've been discussing. So paragraph 10, in fact, not 11, paragraph 10, as we are moving forward, okay, so I know you're going to think that I'm going backwards and doing 9 again. I'm not. I just want to make sure we're getting the context, right, that we get the transition that he's making into paragraph 10. So let's start with verse. Well, let's just reread paragraph 9, and then we'll read into paragraph 10. Everyone who practices sin also practices lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. You know that he appeared in order to take away sins, and in him there is no sin. No one who abides in him sins. No one who sins has seen him or knows him. Little children, make sure no one deceives you. The one who practices righteousness is righteous, just as he is righteous. The one who practices sin is of the accuser, for the accuser has sinned from the beginning. The Son of God appeared for this purpose, to destroy, to unbind, right, to loose, to pull apart the works of the accuser. No one who is born of God practices sin, because his seed abides in him, and he cannot sin, because he is born of God. And by this, the children of God and the children of the accuser are obvious. Anyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor the one who does not love his brother. Okay, so notice where we lead up to there at the end. By this, the children of God and the so he's laid out who the children of the God and the children of God and the children of the accuser are, right? And he says that what they do, right, their actions, and remember all the actions, all the doing, right, doing righteousness, doing sin, that was emphasized, translated here in the NASB as practices, right, but it's that simple do word,
So we've been talking about doing righteousness and doing sin. And he gets into what sounds like a piece of practical application there at the end. Anyone who does not do righteousness is not of God. What do you mean, John? Nor the one who does not love his brother. Ah, okay, loving one's brother, right? Seems to be connected with doing righteousness and thereby manifesting that you are a child of God, or contrariwise, a child of the accuser. So, paragraph 10. For this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we are to love one another, not as Cain, who was of the evil one and murdered his brother. And for what reason did he murder him? Because his own deeds were evil, but his brother's were righteous. Do not be surprised, brothers and sisters, if the world hates you. We know that we have passed out of death into life because we love the brothers and sisters. The one who does not love remains in death. Everyone who hates his brother or sister is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life remaining in him. You know love, we know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers and sisters. But whoever has worldly goods and sees his brother or sister in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God remain in him? Little children, let's not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. Okay, so first off, you'll notice where I've broken this paragraph. Again, that's not universally agreed upon. The primary cue that I'm working with here, as the rhetorical signal for the end of this paragraph, is the repetition, of little children there at the end. That rhetorical move is one we've seen him make, and thus far in the epistle, it has seemed to me pretty clear that when he's like talks about something and then says little children, and then he addresses them or applies it to them or invokes them to do something specific related to what he's been saying, right? That seems to be a kind of paragraph concluding gesture for him. Like he seems to often kind of finish a thought that way, and then after that transition to something else. So I think that sentence, little children, let's not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth, is his, that's his marker that he's sort of done with this paragraph and ready to move on to the next bit. Okay, good. First thoughts here. Randall says, verse 11 begins with that because, which doesn't look to me like the beginning of a new paragraph, but the continuation of the thought of verse 10. Yeah, I was just talking about the end of the paragraph, right? We can think about the beginning. Let's go back to that. Randall's wondering if maybe actually verse 10, instead of being the end of the first paragraph, is the beginning of the next paragraph. And by the way, this is something we've seen several times, isn't it? Where John often places a sort of a transitional thought like that, which is sort of the concluding moment of the previous paragraph and also kind of the springboard into the next paragraph. That's been pretty common. And sometimes this is not the first time we've had this kind of debating, right? To try to figure out, well, do we think it really is it the end or is it the beginning, right? It's I think often a good, it's not necessarily massively substantive, especially in that kind of a case where you have something which is definitely kind of pushing in both directions, right? But still, I think it's an interesting question, and we'll definitely come back to that. Now, Devorah also adds, I'm just going to go out on a limb and predict, what with all this doing talk, that we basically land where DC Talk did with love as a verb. Yes, I the that like loving is a thing that you do, right? Certainly, I mean, the one thing, of course, and Devorah, I also always think of DC Talk when I think of that concept. The question of, okay, I'm going to say this because I think it's true. But I'm willing to be proven wrong about this, is I think that the idea, speaking of love as if it were primarily a feeling, is kind of a modern, feels like a modern thing. I think it's a post-medieval thing. I blame courtly love for this, I think. And it's obviously changed a good deal since then. But I think it's a courtly love thing, post-courtly love thing. Anyway, but so in some ways, I don't think it's a very it's a radical sort of conclusion to suspect that when he talks about loving one another, he is talking about that's what doing righteousness looks like. And DeVore, of course, as we can see now, we'll look at these things in more detail as we go. But I don't think that that John is like transitioning from one thought to to a different thought when he moves from love one another to we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers and sisters, and whoever has worldly goods and sees his brother or sister in need, we should love not in word or deed, or not in word or with tongue, but in deed and in truth. Loving in deed, loving in action, right? So on the one hand, that's clearly how he's describing love, right? Now you might say, well, hang on, the fact they have to say that suggests that the two are not synonymous, right? Which, fair enough, but look what he contrasts it to. He contrasts it not with a vague feeling, but he contrasts it with mere words, right? Is it just words, or does it have the substance too? Right? Is it just, are you just loving with your tongue and nothing else? Right? Is it just what you say, or are there actions behind it? Are you really doing it in addition to just speaking it? It's in on neither half of that equation, right? Is he talking about feelings really at all? He's talking about expressions versus actions. And of course, we will remember how that idea formed the whole like structure of his argument back in paragraphs 2 and 3. Remember, like the person who says this but does that, right, is a liar. He's saying the same thing, right? If you say you that the love of God abides in you, and you see your brother or sister in need and close your heart against them, you're a liar, and the truth is not in you, right? That's, I think, clearly the pattern that he's evoking, that he's kind of prepared us for there at the end. Yep. So I agree. I do think that that's where we're headed, Devorah. And it does seem, he is definitely applying all that, or again, not applying. He's giving us, well, I guess you could say it, one complaint that one could make from near the beginning of John is that he keeps speaking in very general terms, saying things like, don't walk in the darkness, walk in the light. And it would be very easy for a person to read that and say, oh, okay, what does that look like when it's at home? Right? Like, how do I apply that? How do I know if I'm in the darkness? Like, can you be a little more specific about what I'm supposed to do? And by the way, I think it's really important that John has been resisting that as much as he has. He doesn't seem to have any interest in laying out a set of rules or even giving a bunch of illustrations. And at the end of the day, I don't even think that this is an illustration. You could say it is, in one sense. You could say that this is, the whole the business about loving your brother, is a an application, right, of the, an example of what doing righteousness looks like. And yet at the same time, I think it's more than just a random example, right? Randall, that's really interesting. Randall says the way he talks about love in action reminds me of what James says about faith in action. Yes, the show me faith without works, right? And I'll, no, I agree. I agree. Yes. And again, yeah. And Randall, I think that you're very right about that. That again is very much the sort of force of, are your words empty words or are they real? Is your faith empty faith or is it, does it have substance? And either way, there's one way to tell, right? What do you actually do? As again, as he kept sort of focusing on earlier on, not that he was saying that words didn't matter. But again, if your words say one thing and your actions say another thing, it's meaningless. It's a lie. You're only leading yourself astray. It's cool. John says, I just preached on that part of James this morning. Well, there you go. There you go. You're all prepped for this then. All right. So let's go back to the beginning. I want to return to the, I want to return to the whole beginning of the paragraph question, but even before we do that, I just want to note something here, something that's happening in this paragraph. We'll come to understand it better, I hope, as we go through. But the transition from verse 11 to verse 12, doesn't it seem to you a little jarring, right? For this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we are to love one another. Now, how would you expect him to elaborate that? Love one, maybe a positive example, right? Maybe a negative example, potentially. But like, he goes right to Cain, who is of the evil one and murdered his brother. And it's like, well, yes. Yes, that would be a negative example, I suppose, right? But it's like super extreme. Do you see what I mean? It's like, we're not talking about somebody who just like fell short of perfect love for his brother, right? He doesn't give a positive illustration. He goes straight to fratricide, right? He goes way to the opposite pole of loving one another. He brings murder straight into it. Right. As if like having mentioned brothers, like, well, Cain and Abel, right? Let's talk about how one should and should not be related to one's brother. But it feels odd to me at first because it's such an extreme negative example. It's like, oh, okay, right. I might have worked that out on my own. Right. Like if I'm trying to figure out how to abide in God and let God abide in me, like not killing my brothers, I probably would have come up with that one. Right. I would have guessed that murder was probably a thing I shouldn't be doing. But yeah, anyway, that's why it feels odd to me. But there are two things that seem consequent upon his raising of Cain. Oops, perhaps a bad choice of words. Anyway, his raising the issue of Cain, right? One is he goes straight back to the accuser, right? Not as Cain, who was of the evil one. It's as if he, having just been talking about the children of God and the children of the accuser being obvious, he wants to make an obvious example, right? For instance, Cain, right? Like, okay, we can all agree on that, right? That Cain was of the evil one. Okay. So that's one thing. It's the way in which he seems to want to link it back to this idea of being from the accuser. That's one element of the Cain thing, right? But the second element is bringing up death. Again, it's not just about loving one another and failing to love, or like loving one another well or poorly, or loving one another perfectly or imperfectly, right? That's not the issue. Like there's more, going on here, it seems. Because he wants to, he brings death into it. Look at verse 14. We know that we have passed out of death into life. The one who does not love remains in death. Right? So he's going to come back to the death thing. So it's murder. Murder is going to be relevant, not just as an extreme example of love failure, right? But for other reasons too, there's more he's going to do with that. And I think it's connected with the whole being of the evil one thing. But anyway, so I said, we'll sort that out. Last thing I want to note, because I almost forgot about this, that's true, Randall. Randall says his point about Cain's motivation in the second part, the business about his own deeds were evil, right? Is also relevant to everything he's been saying about walking in darkness versus walking in the truth. Yes, yes, leading yourself astray and all that sort of thing. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, so we'll come back to that stuff. But the other thing I wanted to mention, I alluded to it before, but I just wanted to point it out. Notice how we get this. I was about to say random. Of course, it's not random. Almost, I don't think anything in John is actually random. But this sort of free-floating idea in the middle of this paragraph. Do not be surprised, brothers and sisters, if the world hates you. Okay, right? So like that's, now I say, I was tempted to use the word random because it's that sentence, you take it out of this paragraph and you wouldn't miss it, right? That is it doesn't really seem to contribute directly to the primary purpose of this paragraph, right? Again, I'm not trying to say it's irrelevant. I'm not suggesting that we cut it out. I'm just saying it's kind of dropped in there. Do not be surprised if the world hates you. He hasn't been talking about the world. He's not going to go on and talk about the world. It's going to creep in again at the end when he talks about having worldly goods. We'll come back to that little connection. But in any case, this whole idea of the opposition between the Father and the world, which was raised back in paragraph 6, just gets alluded to in the middle of that paragraph. But remember, that's been happening. This isn't the first time that this has happened, right? It happened again back in paragraph 8 as well. See what kind of a love the Father has bestowed on us, that we would be called the children of God, and such we are. For this reason, the world does not know us, because it did not know him. Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not appeared. Once again, you could take that sentence out, and you wouldn't know anything was missing. And if you just went, that we should be called children of God, and such we are. Beloved, now we are children of God. It would flow perfectly well. Right. But he inserted this idea about the world not knowing us because it did not know him right into the middle of that. Right. Just this one reference to the world and to the different perspective that the world has and the antipathy between the world and God and therefore the world and us. Right. And he does the same thing in paragraph 10. Do not be surprised, brothers and sisters, if the world hates you. It's a very similar kind of move, bringing this idea of the opposition with the world into them, kind of overlaying that concept on top of what he's talking about here. And Devor, you're absolutely right. I do think that he's clearly connecting, at least equating, or at least connecting Cain with the world here. Yeah, absolutely. I think the impression that I get in both of those references is that he's kind of pointing back towards paragraph 6, right? He's talking about something else, like the relationship between us and the world is not the primary topic of either paragraph 8 or of paragraph 10, right? But he brings it up. He points back to it because he wants us to sort of remember, like, by the way, keep in mind, right? This also is going to be an issue, right? He's not really developed it yet. He's not really come back to it in full. He laid the foundation for it in paragraph six, and he gave us enough that we can kind of root ourselves back in what he said there earlier on. I think we'll come back around to that a little bit more as we move forward. But just that single sentence pointing back towards paragraph six was another thing that really jumped out at me in kind of looking over the shape of this whole paragraph. But let's consider, Randall, I want to go back to considering your suggestion about the beginning of the paragraph. So Randall's primary argument, and I see, Hoti, yeah. So Randall, if I'm understanding your argument, it is the Hoti that you're not that you don't love as the beginning of the paragraph, because he's starting with a conjunction. Yeah. All right, let's go back for a second here. It's interesting because there is a kind of similarity. The similarity between verse 10 and verse 11, to me, is the this, right? Both of them do that demonstrative pronoun pointing thing, right? In this, tuto, is it tuto? No, it's haute. Okay. Explain the difference to me between tuto and haute. Hoti haute estin. For this is the message compared to through this or in this. It's not through, it's in. En tuto are manifest the children of God. So in both sentences, he's kind of using the demonstrative pronoun, it seems, to point back generally to the content of the whole paragraph, right? Through all this stuff. I could see tuto is just a gender thing. Okay. Great. I did know that. So tuto is masculine or neuter. Aute is feminine. Great. Great. Okay. That helps. Wait. I think it helps. Why? So this is neuter. What? Why is he using a feminine pronoun? Because he's talking about message. He's not pointing back, he's pointing forwards. It's about the message. Aha, right. So with the tuto, he's neuter pronoun, he's pointing vaguely back at the paragraph. But hoti haute, he's talking about the message. Yeah. Yeah, which is feminine. Okay. So the antecedent, which seems misnamed here, as it's not before, but after, but that's okay, is message. This is the message. Yeah, it's a postcedent. Yes, technically. Yes, exactly. Yes, that seems to be what he's doing there. This is the message. So one argument, therefore, Randall, for keeping verse 10 at the end of paragraph 9 is that it sounds like a summation, not a summation, but a conclusion of that paragraph because of the tuto, because he's pointing back, like, in all of this stuff, the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. Anyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor the one who does not love his brother. But hang on a second. I want to postpone further discussion of this because I want to get into the words. And once we get into the words more, I think it might help me understand what's at stake here. Let's come back to Hoti, because once again, I don't trust either the NASB or my interlinear here, because they're telling me they're translating Hoti as four. And Hoti has always seemed to me to mean a little bit more than just, for this is the message. It's like, because when we look at, when looked at Hoti, it's like, yeah, it's because it's a causal word. Since that. Right. Yeah. It's often, it means that and is often used to mean because. Yes. So what that suggests to me is that there's a little something more going on than I think is conveyed with the English conjunction for at the beginning of this sentence. Is it, would it be something like, if you start a sentence with Hoti, like, first of all, how weird is that? That feels weird. I mean, Randall, would you make the more radical argument that you shouldn't even break the sentence? Like that it should be something like, in this is revealed the children of God and the children of the accuser. Each of the not doing righteousness ones is of God. Each of the not doing righteousness ones is not of God, an important distinction, is not of God, and also of the not loving the brother of him ones. Because this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Like, does it make sense to try to make that one sentence? It feels odd. Randall says it feels weird from a Greek point of view to start a sentence with Hoti, but I don't know, because John's Greek's a bit unusual anyhow. Well, exactly. Yeah, it does end up being a really long sentence, but yeah, we've seen those before. However, I will say, you know, and again, obviously I submit to anyone with more Greek experience than I, and that's like most anybody, but what I've been noticing in John's sentences so far, he loves like parallel structure, right? And we were talking about the structure of verse 10 last time. Right? In this are revealed the children of God and the children of the accuser, colon. Pasho, and then another pasho thing. Another two, you know, so we've got the children of God and the children of the devil. Pasho, you know, with the knots, right? Each of the not practicing righteousness ones is not of God, and also the one not loving his brother. So it's not perfectly, it's not perfectly balanced in the sense of like he says, through this are revealed the children of God and the children of the devil. And then he says like a good thing and then a bad thing, right? Like the children of the of God are good in this way and the children of the devil are bad in this other way. That would be like perfectly balanced. And he doesn't do that. His second statement, it does have two parts. So we got the two parts, children of God, children of the devil, and then the two parts, not practicing righteousness and not loving your brother. Right. So it is balanced in parts, but he does a weird kind of thing there. Both of them are negative, right? The not practicing righteousness one is not of God, and the not loving his brother one, right? He's doing something a little bit wacky. Yeah. Oh, Randall. Yeah, I totally resist through this. It's in this. How hard is that? Come on now. Anyway. Yeah. No, I don't. I'm not digging through there either. Does NASB do it? Buy this. In this. Seriously. It's in. Whatever. Okay. Yeah, I don't see any reason not to do that in English either. Whatever. So again, he sets up the parallelism and then plays it out in a kind of a funky way. But it's all kind of there. If we then say we imagine like a semicolon instead of a period here. And then we go on to Hoti, right? Because this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. But really, we'd have to keep going, because not as Cain, who was of the evil one, because who was of, this is subordinate. Not as Cain, who was of the evil one and slew the brother of him. That's not an independent sentence. So you'd have to do the whole thing. That's just too much like a run-on. John likes a long sentence. But again, have you noticed almost all of John's really long sentences are like structurally elaborate? Like verse 10 is structurally elaborate. A little wacky, but, you know, sort of structurally planned. I don't think it works. I don't think it works. It just, because it doesn't correspond to the structure of the previous sentence at all. And then to make it all one sentence. And I would, my guess is that John would be doing that. I know, who am I to say? But that's, so I wouldn't think so. In which case, it looks like we legitimately are starting a sentence with Hoti. And if we're starting a sentence with Hoti, why not a paragraph, right? It's weird. But let us pursue the weirdness, Randall. That is, if it's unusual, the suggestion is that he's going for a particular effect, that he's doing it for a reason, right? Yeah, exactly. As Randall was just saying, maybe it's like starting a paragraph with and or but in English. Our English teachers told us never to do it, but writers do it all the time. Yes, and why? Right? They do it for reasons. Why would you start a paragraph with the word but in English? Because you want to lay an emphasis on the contradiction, right? Because it's a conjunction, the word but, because it's a conjunction, it's easy to kind of skim over it. It doesn't usually receive a whole lot of weight. Sometimes a but can be a very weighty word, of course, but obviously, but you see what I mean? Like, it's normally it's in the middle of a sentence. And so you kind of, and it's a conjunction. You just don't pay that much attention. I mean, you pay a little bit of attention to conjunctions and move on, right? You kind of take their cue and go. But if you really want to land on it, right? But this, like, if you want to announce the thing I am doing, the primary thing I am doing in this paragraph is raising something in opposition to what I just said in the previous paragraph. One way you can emphasize that is by using the word but at the beginning of the paragraph, right? And also has an emphatic function in its own way. With that, it's more like a dramatic pause, right? But in any case, yes, and people telling you, English teachers telling you not to do that sort of thing, it's... you know, it's kind of like when you're learning an instrument or when you're learning almost anything, right? Where you're told, like, don't do this and don't do that. Like, here are the rules and this, you should follow them. But like, once you really get good at playing an instrument, you can break the rules, right? The rules aren't there to restrict what you can do. The rules were there to help you learn like the basic framework of how it's supposed to go. Right. And then once you've mastered it, now you can do the things right that you want to do. And it's the same thing with language. Anyhow. OK, so Hoti. So if you're going to start a sentence with because, much less a paragraph, but let's just go with sentence. You can start a paragraph with Hoti, with because or for since or, you know, for that or whatever. What you're pretty much doing is announcing, you're announcing, again, like starting that the paragraph with but, you are laying a remarkable kind of stress on this. I have to look back, and I haven't had a chance to do it. I don't remember John starting a sentence with the word Hoti before. He's used it a bunch of times, but it almost always introduces the second half of a clause. You know, he'll say like this stuff, Hoti, this other stuff, right? I mean, it's always an important word because it just like Hina or those other kind of like important causal relationship words, right, that he introduces into clauses. You know, the because or so therefore or since or just as, right, all of those kinds of things. That's how he's used it. So this seems to be a break from his own normal usage as well. And it would suggest, inasmuch as Hoti generally suggests causal, like, you know, it's because, right? Because, or like, this is the reason for the thing that came before, right? And he seems to want to emphasize that, right? For this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. So you see how that connects? Again, Hoti is always linking the two things. It's a conjunction, right? It's linking the what came before and what came after. This time, he positions it at the beginning of a sentence, possibly the beginning of a whole paragraph, using that word Hoti as essentially the kind of pivot between paragraph 9 and paragraph 10, right? And he's just been talking about making manifest the children of God and the children of the accuser. In this are revealed the children of God and the children of the accuser. Each of the not practicing righteousness, of the not doing righteousness ones, is not of God. Also the one not loving his brother. That sound radical to you? Right? Do you question whether or not this identity, children of God versus children of the accuser, it's a big deal. It's a big divide, It's a big choice. Do you question whether that is aptly revealed, is fully made manifest by doing righteousness and loving your brother? Because this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. This doesn't come out, what he just said didn't come out of nowhere. There is a because to it, right? There is a hoti. For this is the message that you've heard ap arches from the beginning. Yeah, it does really punch what comes next. This is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. This is the reason. This is the because. This is why it makes perfect sense that the children of God and the children of the accuser would be made manifest, would be revealed by something like whether or not they love their brother. Because from the beginning, the message you have heard is that we should love one another. This is the basic thing, right? That you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Allelus. I love that word. This was a new word for me. Love one another. Yeah. And that's, it seems pretty simple. If we look back to allelon, which is the root here, it's all about reciprocal action, right? One said to another, they began to discuss with one another. Anytime you want to talk about something reciprocally happening between two people, they're using this word, allelon. Whether it's just talking with another, consulting with one another, calling to one another, stepping on one another. Yes. If you trample each other, that's less good, presumably. To be friends with one another. Yeah. Okay. So agapomen, he takes that generic love word. We should love one another. Yeah, and we got hina here too, right? Yes. So that, in order that. This is the message, that we should love one another. However, there will be several other things, three other elements of this verse that should jump out at us, right? Aparkes, we've gotten that several times, right? How does this aparkes fit with the other aparkeses? That's one clear thing. What else do you notice? What other things? Aparkes, that was an easy one, right? But there are at least two other things that we should be remembering from before. Of course, the business about loving. We'll be thinking about the love stuff. But there's more, right? Yes, Devor, back in the No New Commandment stuff is one of the places we'll look at with aparkes. Yes, Aiden, good. The angelia. The angelia. Yes, we've gotten this sort of thing before. In fact, even this, if we go all the way back to paragraph one, okay, so remember we were, our first verb, which it took us ever so long to get to in verse three. Our first verb was, we proclaim, epangelomen. So we've got that angelo right in the middle of that, right? So we're doing this thing with the message. Op angelo, yes, exactly. And then we had it also op angelomen, right? The proclaiming up here. No, it wasn't the main verb of the sentence, but it was about the, you know, the life of the age. The zoen ten ionion, the life of the age. Anyway, so we got op angelomen twice here in paragraph one. And then we got almost this exact same construction in the beginning of paragraph two. And this is the message that we have heard from him and that we preach on angelomen to you. So we were proclaiming op angelomen. He's preaching on angelomen to you. And there's the angelia, the message. And again, aute kai estin aute he angelia. This is a really interesting contrast, isn't it? You can see how he's kind of going out of his way to use hoti in paragraph 10. He could have just said this, and this is the message. He could have just used kai in paragraph 10 if he'd wanted to, right? And this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we are to love one another. By the way, right? He could have just said kai, but he didn't say kai, he said hoti instead, right? He did that kind of that much weirder thing there in 3:11, right? Kai estin and haute, this again with the referring to message, angelia, which is feminine. And this is the message that we have heard from him preach unto you. And what is the message? What is the angelia? That God is light, and in him there is none, there is not none darkness. Was the, and I am assuming that in Greek, as in so many other places, a double negative like that means it's twice as negative, right? That there is not none darkness in him means that there is like totally no darkness at all, right? But anyway, yeah. So we got this exact phrase, almost the exact phrase, except with kai instead of hoti, right? So let's go back. There we go. Yeah, see, it's exactly the same. That we should love one another. God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all was the message in paragraph two. This is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Remember how I said there are those things that John says which seem vague, like the light and darkness stuff. Helpful conceptually, but non-trivial to apply, right? Now he's going back and taking that same thing and he's transforming it, right? This is the message, that we should love one another. So the message was God is light. And now the message is we should love one another. And I don't think he's suggesting that they're different messages. I think this is the message. And I think that what's one of the things that he emphasizes by saying that you have heard from the beginning, like from the beginning of the epistle, as well as other things, right? From the beginning in several senses, right? Aparkes, as we have seen from the beginning, meaning aparkes, like Genesis 1, aparkes, like from the beginning of when you first encountered Jesus, even while Jesus was still alive, right? From the beginning of the Jesus movement, from the beginning of John's own teaching, and even, I think, potentially from the beginning of this epistle, right? And of course, the other element, I was saying there are three elements. Angelia is one, aparches is another, ekousate, you have heard, is another, right? That hearing verb, which has been, of all of those sensory verbs that we got in the first verse, right? You know, that which was from the beginning, which we have seen, which we have heard, which we have seen, which we have looked upon, which we have handled, right? All those things. Of all of those, the one that has kept coming back most often is ekousate, is to have heard, that you have heard aparches. This is the message, that we should love one another. So what does it mean that that's the message that we've heard from the beginning? That we should love one another is the heart of Jesus's teaching, like from the origins of the Jesus movement, from when Jesus was walking around preaching. That's what he was saying, that we should love one another, is one thing that John seems to be saying here, right? This is aparches. This is from the beginning of Jesus's teachings, of what it means to be a follower of Jesus. But of course, the implication also is that we should love one another, in a sense, goes back aparches, to the big arches, right? To the big beginning, to Genesis 1, that this is part of the creation order from the beginning, that we should love one another. And notice where we go immediately in the next verse, Genesis 4, right? Back, not quite to the arches, but pretty close, right? We go back to the beginning of Genesis, back to Cain, and show how the very first instance, the very first manifestation of sin, right? I know, like, the sin of Adam and Eve, I'm not, like, forgetting that or something. And of course, you'll remember he alluded to that explicitly with the things that, remember the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh and the pride of life, which was a following exactly the structure of the Genesis 3 temptation. He's not forgotten about that. And yet when he's talking about the children, he's talking about the offspring of the technia, right? The offspring of God and the offspring of the accuser, and their manifestation, their revelation of those things, of those offspring. So he starts with the original offspring, the first offspring, Cain and Abel, right? And shows, is about to go and show how aparches, from the beginning, it has been made manifest, who is a child of the accuser and who's a child of God. You could see it from the very first offspring that there were recorded in the Bible, right? So again, yes. So that we should love one another goes back to the roots of the Jesus movement, right? But it also goes all the way back to the beginning of the Bible story, right? Back to the earliest generations there in Genesis. And by the way, that's an interesting kind of point, isn't it? If you just go back to the fruit of the tree, if you go back to the first sin, if you go back to the choice of Adam and Eve, it is not immediately obvious, like in the temptation, for instance, right? It's not immediately obvious that that choice, that sin, the sin of, you know, like the choice of Eve to take the fruit, has anything to do with loving one another, right? Like, by itself, what the serpent says to Eve and what Eve thinks and what she does and why she thinks she does it, right? Like, that little passage by itself wouldn't necessarily suggest, or wouldn't necessarily, like, compel us to think that it had anything to do with whether or not we should love one another, or that it was an example of failing to love one another. Although, of course, right, the first thing that we see happening is the division, right? The failure of loving one. Adam and Eve throwing each other under the bus, right? When God comes in the garden, and God's announcement of the division between them, that in fact they will not love one another in the way that they would. So like that, it is tied up with loving one another, becomes pretty clear even before the end of Genesis 3, right? But it is made most manifest in their children, in their offspring, Cain and Abel. Anyway, I'm still talking about aparches here. So this is the message. So I'm trying to answer the question, in what sense is that we should love one another the message that we've heard from the beginning? Again, I think the primary, I would argue that the primary emphasis there is on the teachings of Jesus, that this is what Jesus walked around saying all the time. This is a core of Jesus's own teaching. But it also goes back aparches, back to the beginning as well. But the third sense of aparches, back to the beginning of what John has been telling us. This is the message that you have heard from the beginning. Again, like as in the beginning of this epistle, even, that we should love one another. So I think one sense of this sentence is him saying, this is what we've been talking about. All of that vague walking in light and darkness stuff, all of that like vague keeping the commandments stuff, right? Remember, I was suggesting that John is going to, like if we go back to paragraph 3, oh, that's 5. By this we know that we have come to know him, if we keep his commandments. The one who says, I have come to know him, and does not keep his commandments, is a liar. But whoever follows his word. I remember the question was like, oh, okay, it's like, which commandment? Do we need a long list, right? Should we have a checklist? Like, how does this work? What's he talking about there? Feels less vague than walk in the light, but still, it's a little, you know. And I was suggesting, actually, I think he has a pretty, he's going to be, and I think he's pointing to that here, to this. What are Jesus's commandments? Well, 2 commandments, right? Love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. So yeah, it is all about loving your brother and about the love of God, which of course he's going to go on to talk about in this very paragraph as is, right? Anyway. Okay. Hang on. I want to look for a second. I want to look at tense here. This is present subjunctive active. Okay. Right. This is the message that you have heard. That you heard. Aorist, right? Yes. You heard it. That was a thing. There was that was a moment. You heard it from the beginning. We should love one another. Yes. That we love one another. That we are to love one another, says the New American Standard. That we should love it. Subjunctive is hard to translate. Okay, but it's present subjective. That we should love one another. Okay, so with that stuff in mind, Randall, now let's go back to thinking about the link between the two paragraphs, between the two sentences, because I think they are two sentences. Because this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. each of the not practicing righteousness ones is not of God, and also the not loving the brother of him ones. Because this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. And that, to me, explains the weirdness. I was talking about the weirdness of the balance of verse 10. It would be a tidier piece of elocution to say, through this are manifest the children of God and the children of the devil. Anyone practicing righteousness is of God. Anyone not practicing righteousness is of the devil. Anyone sinning is of the devil. That's kind of what he has been saying all the way through this whole paragraph. That would feel like a more perfectly fitting conclusion to this paragraph, and it would be more perfectly balanced. And again, he's said practically those exact same words earlier on in this paragraph anyway. Like, it's not like it would be shocking. I mean, it is kind of shocking for him to say that, as we discussed many times, but it wouldn't be, we should be expecting it by now, right? Through this are revealed the children of God and the children of the devil. Anyone practicing righteousness is of God. Anyone practicing sin is of the accuser. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Right? I mean, beautifully balanced, forceful final summary of the points that he's making, but it's not what John does. Instead, he sets that up, and he sets it up so clearly that I can, like, hear in my own head how it's supposed to go, right? In other words, right, like how you would take the ideas that he put in this paragraph and do it, but he doesn't do it. Instead, he gives two negatives. Anyone not practicing righteousness is not of God. And also, the one not loving his brother. And these are not two, so where instead of the two separate and balanced things in the second half, we get two things, but one of them is like consequent on the other. Not consequent exactly, but like anyone not practicing righteousness. And by the way, what does that mean? What does that look like? The one not loving his brother. He has, through the structure, he's paralyzed. He's paralleled practicing righteousness and loving his brother, right? He's put those two things in parallel. He's not identified them exactly, right? But he's pointing at these two things. Again, instead of saying neatly, children of God do this, children of the accuser do that other thing, he's saying, think of the general category, practicing righteousness. Do you do it or not do it? If so, you know which bucket you're in, right? Which child you are. Practicing righteousness, doing righteousness. Do you do it or not? Loving your brother. Let's now get down to specifics, right? We can talk vaguely, generally, about doing righteousness. How about loving your brother? Do you do that? Because that reveals the techna to theou and the techna to diabolu, right? That's what makes it clear. So yes, it has the overall kind of shape that we're looking for, but it doesn't do the thing. He instead puts the general and then the sort of the specific manifestation, the more immediately recognizable manifestation. Because it's not just an illustration. It's not just like, there are many ways you can do righteousness. Among those ways is loving your brother. It's more than that. It's much more than that, right? You can almost argue that loving your brother is doing righteousness. And that's why then he transitions with Hoti, because this is the message that you've heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. The Hoti, the because, is the explanation of how it is he can balance doing righteousness and loving your brother the way that he does. Or again, not doing righteousness and not loving your brother, as the case may be in the previous sentence, right? Because this is the message that you've heard from the beginning. So again, it's not about application. It's about pointing to the practical manifestation, the revelation that has always been behind it. And remember, that language is where he started, the manifestation. It's all been about Iphanerothe from the very beginning, hasn't it? What was from the beginning, what we've heard, seen, looked at, handled concerning the word of life, and the life was manifested, was Iphanerothe. It was revealed. And we have seen and testify and proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and which was revealed to us. The fact that the life of the age has been revealed in such a way that we can not only hear it, epargēs, as is happening here in the first sentence, but we can see it, we can look at it, we can handle it. Taking the thing, not just an idea to hear about, but a thing that you can handle. This kind of a revelation. That's been his theme from the start. That's what Jesus was. The revelation of the love of God. That love of God which is revealed also in the fact that we should be called the children of God. And thus, the love of God should be revealed in us. That's how we know. It's how we know that we know him. That's how that we know that we are the children of God. And such we are, right? So this, I think that this is a part of why, I think we're getting some of the payoff. Again, you may remember way back, and in real time, it was 2 years ago when we were looking at the opening paragraphs, paragraph one, paragraph two. And we were talking about how vague those were, as I've been alluding to a lot today. And I was saying, just wait for it, right? That'll pay off. That'll pay off later. And it is. It does pay off, right? That whole shape, manifestation, Phanerothe, revelation, manifestation. This has been a really important motif all the way through this epistle. It's almost given a kind of shape to his thought and his message all the way through from one end of the epistle, well, to the middle. Anyway, I was going to say one end to the next, but we haven't gotten to the other end yet. We've only gotten to the middle, but still, all the way through. I think that we've seen that. Okay. Anyway, we'll come back to Cain next time. So next time, I want to look at the whole story. Oh, hang on. So let me just say in conclusion, I think I am comfortable leaving this at the beginning of the paragraph, though I'm really glad you brought it up, Randall, because I think I love the invisible numbers that are there. Isn't that fun? Anyway, the connection and transition. I'm really glad you brought it up because it raises super important questions. And I'm really glad that we thought about the link between verse, 10 and verse 11. Between 10 and 11 in the way that we did. But I do think it's the beginning of the paragraph. Even also the way in which it parallels the very beginning of paragraph 2, right? And this is the message, replacing the Kai with Hote, as we discussed. But anyway, so next time we will continue thinking about the structure of this sentence. I have been saying that when John does write long sentences, he structures those in interesting ways. What's going on with this sentence? Yeah, and we got a lot. They gave us, what, two and a half sentences in verse 12? Well, we'll see. We might not do the whole of verse 12, but we might. Anyway, next time we will look at the transition. We'll look more at the transition into Cain and look at how this fits with what, with how we have seen John thinking here. Anyway, yep. Okay, awesome. So that's where we'll return next time. Thanks everybody for joining me again this week, and I will see you guys soon as we continue to move through paragraph 10. Thanks, folks. Bye now.
Okay, that's it for this week. I'll be back with another episode soon as we continue our march through 1 John. I'm glad you could join me. Godspeed.